Hi, this is Christina Borgeson at we're the Whistleblower Newsroom. My co-host Celia Farber is out of the country right now on personal assignment. But I'm still very thrilled to present my guest today, who was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, heavyweight in the banking world to blow the whistle on the banking industry's malfeasance that caused the 2008 financial crisis. Malfeasance, by the way, that cost you, me, and every taxpayer in America about $75,000 apiece. Richard Bowen was senior vice president of Citigroup's Consumer Lending Group when he blew the whistle on Citigroup for fraudulently packaging and selling billions of dollars of worthless home mortgages to investors and buyers. He was thrown out of Citigroup for whistleblowing and went to the Securities and Exchange Commission to blow the whistle with more than 1,000 documents backing up his claims 3 months before the bank bailouts that saw our tax dollars go back into the banks that were deemed too big to fail. That was the beginning of Richard Bowen's nightmarish experience trying to get the government to look at his evidence and hold the perpetrators accountable. Now, why is he here today? He's told his story before. Well, it's very interesting because a few weeks ago, you may recall, we interviewed a couple of lawyers from the Lawyers for 9/11 Inquiry Committee who submitted a petition to report federal crimes pertaining to 9/11 that will be heard by a grand jury in New York quite soon. The petition details evidence of explosives contributing to the demise of the World Trade Center buildings and eyewitness accounts that were not reviewed by the government's 9/11 Commission. Shortly after the show aired, Richard reached out to me to say that the whole story of the failure to review evidence and address it resonated very deeply with his experience. So I decided to invite him on our show today to explore that. Welcome, Dick.
Oh, thank you, Christina.
Lay out your story and tell us what inspired you to send me that email.
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, with regard to the story that you did on the 9/11 with David, I think Meiswinkle.
Yes.
Bill Jacoby. I listened to that, and obviously anyone that listened to it was very alarmed. But what particularly resonated to me, and believe me, I'm as you know, I'm familiar with your story and some other stories. But what happened was it just all clicked. I mean, the giant epiphany went off. What had up to this point appeared to be, you know, somewhat similarities that I understood. It really sort of gelled into an epiphany, if you will, that the cover-ups that have existed are really so widespread in so many stories. And at that point in time, I thought that it was just sort of coincidental. These were, you know, my story was, you know, to some extent similar to yours and so forth.
Right.
But that is what really sort of caused the light bulb to go off in my head. And as you know, I sent you an email immediately upon listening to it, just saying, oh my gosh. So really that's what prompted this.
So you've got to tell, I mean, listeners, some listeners may not know your story or other listeners may not know the salient details that are part of this particular view, you know, examination of your story. Just tell your story a little bit, refresh our, listeners, memories.
Okay, I'll try to keep it high level. Obviously, it's very easy to get bogged down into details. But I was with Citigroup, and I was with a subprime mortgage company, and I was one of the chief underwriters for that. And in late 2005, Citigroup reorganized and they consolidated all of their mortgage activities. And in this new organization, this was within the Consumer Lending Group, within this organization, Then I was named in early 2006 business chief underwriter, and I had responsibility to make sure that the $90 billion a year that we were purchasing from other mortgage companies and banks. As a matter of fact, we were purchasing these from over 1,600 different mortgage companies and banks. So understand, in my arena, these were not mortgages that we actually made.
Right.
Citigroup did not originate them. Other banks and mortgage companies did. And it was my responsibility as business chief underwriter to make sure that these mortgages met our policy guidelines.
To make sure they were solid, that this was real money you were talking about. Right.
Well, we were purchasing these, and obviously they had to meet our guidelines. The largest portion of these mortgages that we really are the focus here, I mean, there was a subprime arena where we purchased huge pools of mortgages, and these weren't inconsequential pools of mortgages. These were $200, $300, $400 million in each pool of mortgage. And I discovered in that arena that someone very high up the chain of command, one of the business chief risk officers, was actually reversing my underwriter's decisions.
Who was that?
He was reversing them from turn down to approve.
Who was doing that?
I'd rather not get into names. Obviously, the all of this is now public testimony.
Right.
But and as a result of that, we were purchasing many of these huge pools of mortgages, even over my specific objections.
Did you go talk to this guy and say, "Hey, what's up?"
Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes, and registered my objections. The real story and the real volumes involve another area of the organization, which largely dealt with prime mortgages, but there were others. Now, in this arena, we were purchasing, and this was about $50 billion a year, we were purchasing mortgages, one mortgage at a time. These weren't single mortgages. I mean, these weren't pools.
Right.
And then as Citigroup purchased these, they would turn around and they would sell them immediately to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, mortgage securitizations. And when they sold them, they would give their guarantees and their representations and warranties,
which they got from you, right? Because you sold them and represented them as legit, right?
Well, this is without my feedback. They were giving representations and warranties to the purchasers of these that these mortgages met our policy guidelines.
But were you supposed to have okayed these mortgages before they did that?
Not before. This was after the fact.
Oh. But were you supposed to, before they sold them, were you supposed to check them out and make sure they were good?
No, it was not set up that way.
Oh, okay.
Now, what we did after the fact, and again, this is the way the mechanics were already set up when I inherited it, we would go in and underwrite it and underwrite basically a sampling of these because it was, again, a huge volume.
Right.
And I discovered, and this is in June of 2006, when I was trying to get my arms around these new responsibilities, that I discovered that over 60% of these mortgages that we were purchasing and immediately selling did not meet our guidelines. And yet we were guaranteeing to the purchasers via the reps and warranties that they did meet our guidelines.
So what did you do? You went and talked
Well, silly me, I thought it was my job. So I started issuing warnings. And I sent email. I put it in my weekly report. I made committee presentations. I cornered people in the hallways, even at the water fountain. I'm not a shy guy.
And, so your hair was on fire, but nobody else's was.
That's probably, if I had hair, I would say that would be a good description.
Okay.
So anyway, I continued to send these warnings, and no one could argue with me with regard to what I was finding. They were basically saying, well, these are technical exceptions. And there's no reason to believe that, you know, these are going to perform worse than any other mortgages. Now, understand, Christina, at this point in time, the mortgage boom, if you will, was still expanding.
Right.
I mean, everyone was refinancing their house and then using the money from the refinancing to live off of it for another year and then refinance it again. So
basically, though, you were seeing the writing on the wall.
Well, what I was seeing was they did not meet our policy, and yet we were guaranteeing to those purchasers that they are representing to them that they did meet our policy.
So let's fast forward now to when you blew the whistle, because what I really want to get into is all your efforts to get the government to address this and what happened.
Okay, well, let's finish up at Citigroup, and then we'll jump into the government arena.
Okay.
I kept issuing these warnings and screaming my lungs out for a year and a half into 2007. And basically, I made a decision that I had to get to the board of directors, because obviously everyone in my arena was very familiar with what was going on, and we were not doing anything about it. And anyway, very simplistically, on Friday, November the 2nd, it hit all of the headlines that Citigroup was calling an emergency board meeting for that coming Sunday. And it was speculated in the press that Charles Prince was going to step down as chairman and CEO, and Robert Rubin was going to be named his replacement.
Right.
And I made a decision at that point, I've got to get my warnings to the board. So I Saturday morning, sitting in my kitchen table, I drafted an email. And I sent the email to Robert Rubin, who the next day on Sunday was named chairman of the board. And I also sent it to the chief financial officer, the chief risk officer, and chief financial officer, chief risk officer, and the chief auditor. And knowing, because I'm a CPA, I knew that they had legal responsibilities under Sarbanes-Oxley to report to the board as well as to warn investors.
Right.
Well, bottom line is, we'll fast forward to the part that we're going to be talking about. I got their attention all right. And by the way, in the email, I told them what had been going on for, you know, the last 18 months. And at that point, the volumes had kept increasing, and the rates of defective mortgages had increased to an excess of 80%. And
wow.
Yet we continued to sell and give our representations that these were basically good mortgages.
Wow.
And then I also, quite frankly, I called for an outside investigation. I said, come in here from the outside and investigate what's going on here.
What, you told them you wanted an outside
investigation? Yes, this was in the email.
I think that's where
this
you cooked your
goose. This was in the email that I sent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh. Outsiders coming in to look at the dirty laundry. Mm.
I got their attention all right, and again, we'll fast forward. I was basically stripped of all my responsibilities and told not to come back.
Wow.
And this was not a real fun time in my life.
Yeah, but what did they say, though? Like, what was their rationale for telling you to leave? I mean, they had to have a reason to fire you. What was it?
No, I wasn't fired. I was placed on administrative leave.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, in any event, this was actually in January, I believe, of 2000. And again, I'm leaving out a lot of the details.
Right.
But this was in January of 2008.
Right.
By the way, I had also sent a number of emails asking to actually speak with someone immediately after I sent the email. And I did get an acknowledgement that they had received the email from a general counsel, but they refused to talk to me until after the end of the year.
So they handed over your email to the general counsel, and you did not get a direct response from anybody. You got the lawyer's response.
No, and in fact, I'm convinced that the reason that they did not respond to me is they did not want to know the details behind it so they could sign the certifications that the internal controls were effective, because I specifically referenced in the email that the internal controls were broken and we had unrecognized losses.
Well, that was a bogus move, because you know something's wrong. So just because you don't know the details of what's wrong doesn't mean you don't know something's wrong.
Well,
so,
I know, but know? Nonetheless, you know, they're required under Sarbanes-Oxley to swear that the internal controls are effective at the end of every quarter.
Well, you had alerted them to the fact that
yes.
they were not. So
yes.
what if they swore that to start?
Yes.
They were already in
and
the
by
wrong.
By the way, this is another interesting note. They actually swore that the internal controls were effective for the third quarter the day after I sent my email. So,
well, that's what I mean. Aren't they?
Yes.
Aren't they? Can't they be held liable for that?
Well, you would think so. 60 Minutes did a story on it, asking why they haven't been.
And who did they ask?
Answer to that.
Oh.
Well, they ask an attorney on the show. So,
okay.
In any event, let's fast forward, because this is really where it gets interesting, and the parallels are uncanny, if you will.
Okay.
With regard to, for example, the 9/11 show that we discussed.
Right.
I went to the SEC, and this was in July, actually it was, I believe, July the 15th and 16th of 2008. Now, understand, the bank bailouts did not occur until beginning in October, I believe.
So that was a few months down the line. So this was before
right.
the bank bailouts.
That's right. This was at least three months before the bank bailouts.
Right.
And I spent 2 days talking to the SEC. I gave the SEC over 1,000 pages of documents evidencing the fraud that I had witnessed within Citigroup.
And who did you give that to at
these
SEC?
There were a number of prosecutors there from the enforcement division of the SEC.
The enforcement division. Okay.
Yes, and quite frankly, they got very excited, Christina.
Oh, they always do in the beginning.
No, they did. I mean,
they always do in the beginning.
They basically told me, Mr. Bowen, we are going to pursue this.
Yeah.
I mean, these prosecutors mm-hmm. were going to make their bones on this.
Yeah. Wait till the head of the SEC gets wind of these 1,000 documents. That's what I say.
Well, you're getting a little bit ahead of us. But,
okay.
Basically what happened was they got very excited. They mm-hmm. said they're going to pursue this. In fact, they wanted me to stay over. And my attorney couldn't stay over the next day and said they were going to call me and pursue this. The bottom line is I never heard from them again. And, it gets better than that. From my standpoint, they not only buried my testimony, they locked it up. Obviously, the bank bailouts then happened, and Citigroup was bailed out to the tune of $350 billion
yeah.
in capital and toxic asset guarantees. But what has subsequently happened is the SEC has refused to release any of the documents that I gave to them under multiple requests.
Why?
Under the Freedom of Information Act. Oh, well, no. The official reasons that they have given have been that they are confidential and trade secrets.
Oh. So let me get this straight, Richard. Documents proving malfeasance are trade secrets?
Well, all I'm telling you is this is the official reason why the SEC has continued, even through today, has continued to refuse to release any of these documents.
Yeah, but isn't there some kind of legal law that says, listen, if your documents contain evidence of a crime, they can't be secret. Your crime cannot stay in the dark.
Christina, I am not an attorney, nor do I play one on TV.
Okay.
But
it is a
let
question.
Me tell you that I want to warn your listeners of something here, and this is very important, because they said all of the documents were confidential and trade secrets. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I guess that includes the fraudulent representations which were given to the purchasers of mortgage-backed securities, which I printed off the Internet from the SEC's own website.
Wow. Wow.
Out of the prospectuses that were for the mortgage securitizations. So I want your listeners to be very, very careful, because I know that everyone looks on the Internet. And they need to be careful, because what they see on the Internet can be confidential and trade secrets.
Now, could you tell me where they can look at this confidential trade secrets information about the fraudulent dealings?
I don't know where they can get it. The SEC won't receive it, won't release it.
I thought you got it off the Internet yourself, so I wanted to know where our listeners could get it off the Internet.
I did get those documents off the websites.
Which website? The banks?
Well, you go to the website where they have all of the prospectuses for the listed securities.
Okay.
And there's a number of mortgage-backed securitizations that Citigroup had sponsored, and it's contained in those prospectuses, these representations.
So these are on the Citigroup website?
No, this is on the SEC's website.
Oh, the SEC's website. Oh, okay. Okay. So there you go. There's some of the information that they...
Oh, absolutely.
They say are trade secrets.
And in fact, when 60 Minutes did their story, they actually read one of the securitizations on the air, the representations.
Good. Yay for them.
So the real concern now, obviously, you can ask yourself the question: Why would the SEC refuse to release any of this information? And I'm asked that a number of times, and I don't know. I'm sure it would be somewhat embarrassing if they admitted that the government had full knowledge of what was going on at Citigroup before they bailed them out to the tune of $350 billion.
Well, that cat is already out of the bag. So, okay, so that's government agency one, okay, that put the kibosh on an investigation and accountability. So then you moved on to the FCIC. Could you tell our listeners what the FCIC is and what happened there?
Well, Congress chartered the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the so-called Independent Congressional Commission, to investigate what went on in the financial crisis.
So that's the banking equivalent, the banking crisis equivalent of the 9/11 commission.
Oh, yes, yes,
okay.
Yes. Exactly it is.
Okay. With kind of similar results.
Well, you're getting ahead of the story.
Okay, okay, I'm sorry.
They specifically charged the congressional commission that if they find evidence of criminal wrongdoing, then they are supposed to send that evidence along with referral for criminal prosecution to the Attorney General of the United States. That was actually in the legislation that chartered the commission.
Okay.
Well, I will tell you that I testified behind closed doors on February the 27th, 2010, and this was before the senior investigative and the legal staff of the commission. But before I even got there, Christina, I had told them, as we had a number of phone conversations leading up to this, I had told them about my going to the SEC and all this treasure trove of documents that existed at the SEC.
Right.
So before I even got there, they had sent their investigators over to the SEC, and they had gone through the 1,000 pages of documents that I had given the SEC.
Wow, okay.
So when I got there, they already knew the story.
Right.
But again, I told it to them anyway.
Right.
and I gave them some additional stuff. And guess what?
What?
They got excited.
Okay.
And they said, Mr. Bowen, we may want you to testify. And I said, well, okay.
Testify before?
Well, in an open hearing.
Okay.
And actually, on March the 22nd, I received an official invitation from the commission to testify an open hearing on April the 7th.
Okay.
And in the letter and in side conversations, they told me, besides my presentation, which would be carried on national television, to give them written testimony. They wanted written testimony also. And they told me I can have up to 30 pages of written testimony.
Okay.
And they even told me what they wanted me to include in that testimony.
Which was?
You know, a lot of the damning evidence that I had told them about and had gone to the SEC about.
Okay.
And they wanted me to submit that written testimony by March the 29th.
So a week before.
Well, it's, you know, I got the, yeah.
The public hearing.
Yeah, yeah. The you know, 7 days after I received the invitation, which was a little hectic, but I managed to do that. And so on March the 29th, I submitted to the SEC my 28-page written testimony. I say submitted, I put it in the mail.
Right.
They asked me to send them 20 copies, by the way. I knew they were tight, but that was, I sent it to them, the 20 copies. Now, when they received it, Christina, the next day, on the 30th, it was as if the whole world had changed. And they said basically, yeah, Bowen, yeah, we know we told you you could submit up to 30 pages, but we have decided that it is too long.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so now their interest goes from 29 pages to how many?
Well, it was 28 pages.
28 pages.
And they said,
and
we will tell you exactly what to take out.
Oh,
of
hello.
Your testimony.
Hello. There we go.
And for example, you know, you went to the SEC. You gave them over 1,000 pages of documents 3 months before the bank bailouts. They got excited, and then they dropped it. Take it out. Again, it's too long. Your concerns about violations of law. I talked about Sarbanes-Oxley and how I felt that law had been violated. They said, take that out also.
What?
They also said that the fraudulent representations which were given to the purchasers of mortgage-backed securities. Now, they acknowledged that in the letter they had, you know, told me to put that in, but again, it was too long. I needed to take it out.
What? I mean, that's the crime right there.
Now, I'm just telling you what happened, Christina.
God, okay.
And by the way, let me finish this and we'll circle back. These aren't just my allegations, by the way.
Yeah, no, I know that.
They also said, you know, all of the names and the specific instances of cover-ups that they had asked me to include, they also asked me to take those out.
So they don't want you naming names either. So you can't talk about the crime and you can't name names. All right, so what's...
Well, and the last major item was, take out what happened to you after you sent the Rubin email, that you were stripped of all your responsibilities and told not to come back to the bank. And then they also made it clear that the edits were not optional. If I did not make the edits, I would be taken off the witness list.
Wow.
And in that case, Christina, I could never tell anyone anything because I had a very severe confidentiality agreement with Citigroup, But I was exempt from that. I could tell the commission anything, but if I wasn't allowed to talk to the commission, then I could never tell anyone anything, and they knew that.
Oh my God! I mean, that's a conspiracy.
Well, I'm just sticking with the facts.
You know, I mean, they, first of all, it's like they tell you, you know, the bank says, okay, you can talk to the commission, but then the commission sets it up so that you can't give the names or detail the crimes that the bank. That's crazy.
Well, let me digress, and again,
in terms of trying to get
tell
it.
You,
okay.
Let me finish this part of the story, and then we'll broaden it a little bit.
Okay.
Now, people have asked me, you know, what happened between March the 29th, when I had been told, you know, very specific testimony to put in the mail, and on March the 30th, when they received it. And obviously, this, you know, the sun and the moon and the stars had all changed orbits. You know, Everything changed. And the only thing I can tell you is that on March the 29th, after I had put my testimony in the mail, it hit all of the headlines in the country, and your readers can look this up, that the largest single shareholder in Citigroup, the U.S. Treasury, was going to sell on the open market its 7.7 billion shares of stock in Citigroup.
Oh, so this information about the crimes and the who did what was not going to be good for the value of the stocks.
Well, all I'm saying is, and this is the headlines, you can look it up.
Yeah.
This was good news, and this was also in the headlines. It was good news because the bailout, and by the way, there were press briefings. I heard there was a background press briefing at the White House. So there was interviews with the Secretary of the Treasury, Geithner, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
This was good news because not only did the bailout save the country, but the United States government was going to make a profit of $7.5 billion on the stock.
Wow.
If the price of the stock stayed high. And this was all in the headlines.
Oh,
it was in the press. People ask me, you know, how could that have anything whatsoever to do with the independent congressional commission? And I can't say that it did. But I can tell you it happened. You
well,
can look
there's
it up.
No. Well, I mean, if one arm of the government is making money off of this criminal enterprise or this enterprise, you know, let me put it another way, this enterprise engaging in questionable, probably criminal activity, there's a conflict of interest right there. You know, there's a conflict of interest right there.
Well, you might think.
It is a conflict of interest. There's no question about that. But okay, so now.
Well, let me finish this. You know, mentioned that these aren't just my allegations. I will tell you, the New York Times did a complete investigation on this.
Right.
They assigned fact checkers to it. This was
Bill Cohen's piece?
Yes, this is a lead article that Bill Cohen. It was a full-page op-ed that appeared, I believe it was in the September 22nd Sunday edition of the 2013 of the New York Times, full-page New York Times op-ed. And they outlined exactly what had happened. So they confirmed everything that had happened.
Right.
So, again, you know, this isn't just, you know, Richard Bowen out there crying wolf. You know, some other people have confirmed that, you know, the wolf actually existed.
Didn't another reporter actually have problems? Actually a former guest on this show. Right? Cheryl Atkinson. What happened to Cheryl?
Oh, sure. I will tell you, Cheryl is I think the world of her. I received a call from one of Cheryl Atkinson's producers that I had met when she was in an earlier life. And she said, we want to do a story. And this was, I guess this originated in early 2000 or later 2016. In fact, let me set the stage for this. Before we leave the commission, as the commission was going out of business, there was, I think, some press conferences and including the chairman, they said, we vow transparency to the American people. We want the American people to know what we found out.
And they said this after they had censored your testimony?
Yes. This was as they were concluding the commission.
Right.
And basically what happened was... they said, we want you to know, and in fact, they had their last press release. They released it, and they said, we're even going to give you the transcripts of all of the witnesses that we have interviewed. And you can go to their website, and it's still there, by the way.
Right.
And you will find a list of the hundreds of names of witnesses that appeared before the Congressional Commission. And you can go down that list, Christina, and you can click on a name, and you can download the complete transcript, every word that was uttered in talking, in interviewing the witness. And you can click on another button in many instances, and you can download documents that they gave the commission. And quite frankly, on many of them, you can click on a button, and you can download the MP3 file and listen to the testimony on your bicycles in the morning. Now that is transparency. Right?
Now what happens when you look for Richard Bowen?
Well, it's funny how that works. If you go down that list of the hundreds of names, and by the way, in the list of the hundreds of names they published in their last press conference or the last press release, it actually lists all the names, including Richard Bowen. But if you go to their website and you look down the list, you won't find Richard Bowen.
That is a scandal. That's a scandal. By the way, Richard, we were talking about Cheryl. Didn't Cheryl, while she was covering your story, didn't she get a call from the commission's lawyer?
Well, that's actually, I'm going to come back to Cheryl.
Oh,
but I'm trying to lay some groundwork for talking about Cheryl Atkinson, because she was wonderful in this.
Oh, she's
so
a champion.
The whole point is... they basically made the decision that everything that I gave them, everything I said behind closed doors, everything that apparently they got from the SEC, everything including my original written testimony, had to stay confidential.
Why? Trade secrets again?
So they sent it to the National Archives, with instructions that the National Archives could not release it for 5 years. So, you know, I've been asked, you know, why 5 years? I don't know. I'm sure it's just a coincidence that 5 years is a statute of limitations for fraud. I'm sure it's just a coincidence, right, Christina?
That isn't that actionable against the commission, isn't it, or the government, isn't that actionable that you withhold evidence of a crime until the statute of limitation passes? Isn't that a crime?
Christina, that's above my pay grade.
Well, I just wonder if what the laws say about that. I'm going to check that. I wish I could tell my listeners now.
I think it would be very interesting to get that opinion. But anyway, in setting the stage for Cheryl Atkinson.
Okay.
In 2016, the 5 years had elapsed, and the National Archives issued a press release saying that they were releasing many of the documents and would be releasing more documents from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. And so this is where my conversation with Cheryl Atkinson comes into play. Cheryl Atkinson and her producer, interfaced with the National Archives, and I told them I actually got a list of the documents from the National Archives, and I circled some file names that looked suspicious. They were related to me. And they actually obtained them from the National Archives.
What do you mean they look suspicious?
Well, they were related to me. But for example, there was a file name that was called Richard Bowen Testimony Draft, and it had all capitals D-R-A-F-T on it. Uh-huh. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. So they actually, Cheryl's staff. Cheryl and her producer actually obtained that document and shared it with me. And guess what?
What?
That was my original sworn testimony.
Wow.
They had cleverly disguised it with the name Draft.
Wow.
When they sent it to the National Archives. You know, Cheryl was excited. I was excited. We filmed a show that she was going to do, talking about it. And by the way, in this same setting, Elizabeth Warren had assigned her staff, her investigative staff, to review all of the documents in the National Archives, specifically the minutes of
right.
the commissioner meetings. And they actually discovered that the National Archives, and this is the first time it was known, actually fulfilled its mandate from Congress. You know, I'd said before, if they find evidence of criminal wrongdoing, then they are to send that evidence along with a referral for criminal prosecution to the Attorney General of the United States. Well, and by the way, Elizabeth Warren sent a couple of public letters demanding the reasons why, and this was in the press. Her staff discovered that the Congressional Commission actually fulfilled its mandate, and they actually made 11 criminal referrals and sent all of the evidence along with 11 specific criminal referrals to the Attorney General of the United States, who basically sat on them.
And that would be Eric Holder, right?
That would be Attorney General Eric Holder.
Who,
yes.
By the way, let's make that connection right away. Eric Holder was on that list of Citigroup's Michael Froman, who was an executive there when Obama was running for president, and he was the one who sent a memo to Obama listing suggestions of people to fill positions in his administration. And Eric Holder, this is Citigroup again, Citigroup's
yes.
Michael Froman suggested that Eric Holder become Attorney General. Okay, so now
Don't forget also that Froman was basically the chief of staff under Rubin when he was Secretary of the Treasury in the Clinton administration.
Okay. Right. And Rubin, you know, he did this. He came in, changed some regulations in the interests of the banks, and then left. You know, I mean, that was his, I believe it was Rubin. Am I correct about that?
Oh, yes.
I'm pretty sure
oh,
it's
yes.
Rubin.
And that's another story.
So Eric Holder, the bank... You know, the bank executive who suggested him who basically helped him get his job, he now is supposed to be reviewing 11 criminal acts on the part of that bank. So now what do we have again?
These were across many banks. Don't get me wrong. This wasn't just all Citigroup.
Yeah, but in this case, it was your 11 Citigroup's submission. My point to you is it's a conflict of interest for Eric Holder, I think, given how he even got that job, for him to be reviewing any malfeasance that has to do with Citigroup.
You're a troublemaker, aren't you?
Well, no. What I'm trying—it's not that I'm trying to make trouble. I'm trying to keep things clean. I would like to see things kept clean. You know,
okay.
Because we're paying Eric Holder, even though Citigroup got him the job.
To continue the story, and I actually am circling back to Cheryl Atkinson.
Okay.
What Senator Warren's staff found, and this is actually published, that one of the 11 criminal referrals was based solely on my testimony and evidence that I had given the commission. And it did reference, and this was actually what was published in the documents that Elizabeth Warren published, that Robert Rubin's name was in association with that.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So, anyway, back to Cheryl. Cheryl obtained the my original written testimony, which was, again, a revelation to me. And we were excited. We filmed some shows, and she was going to run the show when all of a sudden she received a phone call from one of the former staff members with the commission, who, according to Cheryl, basically threatened to sue her if she ran the story.
He threatened to sue her based on what?
Well, obviously, it didn't happen. I wasn't forced to change my testimony. And so, in any event, I provided documentation to Cheryl about it. And Cheryl also interfaced with Bill Cohen, who had done a great deal of research on it originally when he wrote the New York Times op-ed.
Right.
And to Cheryl's credit, she actually published the story. And in fact, if you see that story, she actually refutes, if you will, she never mentions names, but she actually refutes suggestions that that I was not forced to change my testimony. In fact, she actually used some of the documents I gave her that prove that I was. So, Cheryl is a great lady. I will tell you, she's a very strong, independent lady that is seeking the truth, and she will stick with her guns.
Now, your lawyer was involved in shenanigans on this issue too, wasn't he?
Well, an attorney that I had I'd had a lot of the communications through, and that Bill Cohen interfaced with, and was actually quoted him in his New York Times op-ed as, you know, totally agreeing that I was basically forced to change my testimony, opined that, no, I wasn't forced to change my testimony. And the individual from the commission that called was basically quoted and that is another reason, you know, there was threatened litigation.
Well, why did he suddenly opine that, do you suppose?
I don't know.
Everybody, you know, other whistleblowers that I've talked to, they, many, many, many of them always come, often, not always, often come to a point where they discover that their lawyer is not on their side anymore.
Well, I will tell you, Cheryl, from my experience, I've had two previous attorneys, and it's my experience that the attorneys very quickly discover which side of the bread the butter is on, and it's never your side.
I'll tell you, it's kind of crazy, and you know, it's the interesting thing about Citigroup is, you know, I'd like to go back to the stock market crash, which was, of course, 1929, and when the government held hearings on that, too. And apparently not a whole hell of a lot was happening. until they decided they needed to have somebody write a final report. And they had this Ferdinand Pecora, who was assistant district attorney for New York County, to write the final report. But it turns out that Pecora was used to dealing with organized crime, and he was a, you know, he knew how to interview criminals. And so he decided that before he was going to write the final report, that he was going to talk to these bankers that had already talked during the hearing, had been asked questions, okay? And guess what? He spoke to Sunshine. They called him Sunshine Charlie. He was the head of Citigroup.
That's right, Sunshine Charlie. That was his very first witness, by the way, when he was calling hearings.
And he was the head of then Citigroup Bank.
And the forerunner, yes.
Exactly. And he admitted to Pecora that, guess what? What did he do? Packaged bad loans into securities and sold them by billing them as good securities. You know? So
where have we heard that before?
Exactly. And
well, of course, it was then outlawed. We passed Glass-Steagall in response to that.
Exactly. And guess what? Glass-Steagall was working. The banks behaved for about 50 years.
That is correct.
And then, again, they started...
Well, that got us into the 1980s when we started deregulating.
Exactly. Exactly. And then you had, in the 80s, you had the Keating scandal. It was Charles Keating who was CEO of the giant Lincoln Savings and Loan Association, who was looting his own firm to illegally buy up real estate. When the bank regulators got onto him, five senators, the now deceased John McCain, former astronaut John Glenn, Alan Cranston, Don Riegel, and Dennis DeConcini tried to quash that investigation and pressure bank regulators, including Mr. Black, our friend Mr. Black, to give Keating a pass. Okay, and he refused, and that's what triggered the congressional investigation of Keating. So these and of course, interestingly enough, there was a memo that Keating wrote. He was so upset at Black that he wrote, "Get Black, kill him dead," metaphorically, of course. So, but anyway, that investigation, that collapse cost the American taxpayer more than $3 billion. And that was a lot of money back in those days. This one, according to the Financial Crisis Commission, cost $22.5 trillion.
And don't forget the other analogy there, Christina. In the 80s banking and S&L crisis, we actually vigorously prosecuted and we sent over 800 senior bankers to prison, to the slammer. And this last financial crisis, which has cost, you know, many, many times that.
Yeah, $22.5 trillion.
We have prosecuted, in essence, zero very senior bankers.
So what's happened here? What's happened here, Richard? What are we going to do about it in 1 minute or less? Let's solve this problem. I've got 1 minute left. What are we going to do?
Well, we need to get Washington's attention, and unfortunately, I don't think...
But Washington's on board with the bankers.
No, that is very true. That is absolutely very true.
I mean, you know, this is, I don't know, this is the big worry. I mean, where is the accountability going to come from? I mean, these people are bankrupting the world.
Yes.
You know, they really are. There doesn't seem to be any institution, and of course they're brutal, as you personally have experienced. You know, they're brutal when it comes to protecting themselves and destroying anybody who would bring them to account.
Oh yes.
So and you know, I don't want to feel like I watched Elizabeth Warren chastising a banker, I forget who it was, on C-SPAN once, and it was the most pitiful thing because she was saying, you do this and you do that, and she just looked so powerful. I mean, he was just looking at her sort of impassively, you know, and she looked so powerless, and I just thought, you know, how is this going to change? This has got to change.
Well, I, for the sake of our country, I certainly hope it does, because I will tell you, you take a look at this, and there is no doubt in my mind that we will have another financial crisis. And when this other financial crisis hit, it's going to be a many times worse than this one. Because quite frankly, the only lesson that was learned from this last crisis is there's no downside to doing this. That's what the bankers have learned.
Yeah, for the bankers, there's no downside. For the rest of us,
right.
It's like... Well, listen, I just loved having this chat with you. We've got to wrap
and
up.
I have too. Well, let me tell you that, you know, there is life afterwards. I became a professor at the University of Texas at Dallas. I like to tell people I was thrown out of city, so I became a professor. And, you know, there is hope with our young people.
Yes, yes, I agree. Well, we're going to pass it on to the millennials, and that's the last. Those are the last words on it for now. But thank you so much, Richard, for coming on. I appreciate it very much. It was a pleasure having you.
I likewise did.
All right. Thank you.
You bet.